contain in Bit War with Kelly.
Hallo zusammen und damit herzlich willkommen zur Neujahrsfolge von Wunder, Wissen, Weltkrieg. Mein Name ist Raffaela Höfner. In jeder Folge spreche ich mit ehemaligen Soldaten, mit US-Veteranen, mit Überlebenden und Opfern des Zweiten Weltkriegs. Hört aus erster Hand die Erlebnisse, die Schrecken und Wunder, die meine Gäste selbst erlebt haben. Hier geht es um den Tatort Zweiter Weltkrieg, ein Podcast gegen das Vergessen und für den Frieden. Dezember 1941. Ängstlich sehe ich mich um. Meine Mutter geht dicht vor mir und ich spüre, wie auch ihre Furcht mit jedem einzelnen Schritt wächst. Mein Koffer ist viel zu schwer zu tragen. Bald werden wir es doch geschafft haben. Sie kommen nach Dresden, bellt eine Stimme. Dresden? Ist das nicht in Deutschland? Wir sind doch hier ganz woanders. Wir werden in eine Baracke getrieben und ich erfahre, dass diese Dresden heißt. Ein paar Kinder weinen. Ich schlucke mit aller Kraft die Tränen herunter. Ich will meine Mutter nicht traurig machen. 10 bis 12 Frauen mit Kindern werden zu uns in den kleinen Raum getrieben. Stockbetten klammern sich an die kahlen Wände. Geflüster. Eine Frau strafft mutig die Schultern und richtet das Wort an einen der Aufseher. Wann werden wir unsere Männer wiedersehen? Die Väter unserer Kinder. Keine Antwort. Wann? Die Frau lässt nicht locker und blickt den Aufseher an. Stille. Morgen früh um 6 Uhr könnt ihr sie sehen. Schaut dann aus dem Fenster. Die Männer gehen um 6 zur Arbeit. Gibt ihr kurz zurück. Dann werden wir allein gelassen. Meine Mutter versucht, etwas Wärmeres zum Anziehen aus dem Koffer zu holen. Es ist Dezember und eiskalt. Hier im Raum kann ich meinen Atem sehen, wie in kleinen Wolken aufsteigt. Schnell suchen wir uns ein leeres Stockbett und legen uns auf die Matratze. Die dünne Decke kann mich nicht aufwärmen. Die erste Nacht ist schrecklich. Ich sehne mich nach meinem Zuhause, nach meinem Bett, nach meinen Spielsachen, nach Vater, nach den Großeltern. Vater, schießt es mir wie eine Flamme in den Kopf. Schnell bin ich auf den Beinen und eile zum Fenster. Ein paar der anderen Kinder stehen bereits davor und blicken nach unten. Dann sehe ich die Kolonne. Die Männer gehen in 5er Reihen über die Straße. Ihre Köpfe hängen herunter und erinnern mich an sterbende Tulpen. Vater, rufe ich aus vollem Hals. Vater, Ernst, Anusch. Auch die anderen Kinder brüllen und hoffen auf einen kurzen Blickkontakt. Keiner der Männer sieht auf. Warum nicht? Können sie uns etwa nicht hören, nicht sehen? Das ist doch unmöglich. Ein paar der kleineren Kinder weinen verzweifelt. Die Mütter können sie nicht beruhigen. Die Angst greift nach meinem Herzen und zerquetscht es wie eine Zitrone. Wo ist Großvater? Ich habe ihn in der Kolonne nicht ausmachen können. Werde ich überhaupt noch jemanden meiner Familie wiedersehen? Ich klammere mich an die Hand meiner Mutter. Sie ist der letzte Strohhalm hier, der mir geblieben ist. Die erste Folge im neuen Jahr habe ich einem ganz besonderen Gast gewidmet. Gidon Lew ist Überlebender des Holocaust, bekämpft Hass und kämpft für Liebe und Toleranz für alle Menschen. So steht es in seinem TikTok- und Instagram-Profil. Gidon wurde am 3. März 1935 als Peter Wolfgang Lew in der damaligen Tschechoslowakei in Karlsbad geboren und wird dieses Jahr 88 Jahre alt. Seine Familie floh 1938 aus dem Sudetenland nach Prag, nachdem die Nazis dieses annektiert hatten. 1941, nur wenige Jahre später, wird Gidon mit seiner Familie in das Konzentrationslager Theresienstadt, ein Nazi-Ghetto, transportiert. Damals ist er erst 6 Jahre alt. 26 von seinen Familienmitgliedern werden im Holocaust ermordet. Darunter ist auch Gidons Vater, der auf dem Transport von Auschwitz nach Buchenwald stirbt. Gidon erlebt als Kind die Schrecken in Theresienstadt, den schlimmen Hunger und die harte Arbeit. Erst 10 Jahre alt, als die Rote Armee das Konzentrationslager im Mai 1945 befreit. Von den über 9000 inhaftierten Kindern ist er eines von mehr als 2000, die schätzungsweise überlebt haben. Nach ihrer Befreiung aus Theresienstadt wandern Gidon und seine Mutter 1949 in die USA und später dann nach Kanada aus. 1959 kommt Gidon nach Israel, wo er auch heute noch lebt. Ich hatte sehr großes Glück, dass Gidon und seine Lebensgefährtin Judy Gray sofort zugesagt haben, ein Video-Meeting mit mir zu machen. Die beiden haben jeden Tag sehr viele Termine. Bildungsorganisationen wollen mit ihnen sprechen, Journalisten sowieso. Dann wird auch noch ein Dokumentarfilm über Gidon gedreht. Gidon hat sehr viele Verluste im Leben hinnehmen müssen. Dennoch bezeichnet er sich als großen Optimisten und als Schelm. Jeden Tag begeistert er über 400.000 Follower auf TikTok und hat für seine Videos knapp 8 Millionen Likes bekommen. Sein Ziel ist es, vor allem die junge Generation über den Holocaust aufzuklären. Im Netz kämpft er auf diesem Weg gegen Antisemitismus, gegen Diskriminierung und gegen Hass. Ich nehme euch jetzt mit in das Interview, damit ihr Gidons Geschichte und seinen Werdegang aus erster Hand erfahren könnt. Gidon spricht zwar fließend Deutsch, hat aber darum gebeten, das Interview auf Englisch zu geben.
Okay. So, du mir versuchen zu sprechen ein bisschen in Englisch.
Ja.
Das ist viel leichter für mich,
ja,
zu sprechen in Englisch. Von Zeit zu Zeit, wir können ein paar Worte in Deutsch sprechen.
Ja.
Ich bin doch geboren in Karlsbad, so dort, aber doch, ich habe täglichen Zeit, durchsprechen meistens Englisch oder Hebräisch.
Ah, okay, Hebräisch auch. Ah, toll.
Ja.
Wann sind Sie geboren worden?
So I was born in 1935 in Karlsbad and to middle class parents who owned a Alteisengeschäft in Karlsbad.
Did you speak German or Czech with your parents?
I spoke both Czech and German because on my mother's side we spoke German and my father's side spoke Czech. So I grew up speaking two languages.
It's always good to speak more languages so you can communicate way easier with other people.
Exactly. You know, Amundsen said once, every time you speak another language, you enter another world.
Yeah, that's true.
There is some truth. And your English is good.
Thank you.
I lived in Toronto for about 10 years.
Mm-hmm. I've never been to Toronto.
Do you have questions and I will answer.
Do you have any childhood memories? How it was like when the Wehrmacht came to Czech Republic, how things changed for you guys?
I have quite a lot of memories. So where do you want me to start? That's the question. You want me to start from the beginning after I was born and so forth and so on?
Yeah, yes? That would be great, yes.
Okay, so look, I was born in 1935. At that time in Germany, Hitler was already in control. And I can show you an interesting picture because it will show you a little bit the way the people at that time, the Jewish people in Karlsbad, in Prague, were actually feeling. I'll show you this picture. You can see here. Can you see?
Yes.
Okay, you have here, going from here, my father, my mother, my grandfather, and my great-grandmother. Rosa Savage was her name. And I'm here too, but you can't see me because I'm in my mom's tummy.
Yeah.
It was 1934. So 1934, you can see they are walking sort of on a promenade in Carlsbad. And they seem very happy.
And really very fancy clothes, really nice clothing.
Very nice clothing, relaxed. What was going on in Germany sort of seems to be a long way away. Really but the frame of mind of my parents and probably many Jewish people was, what's happening in Germany is not in the Czechoslovakian Republic. Of course, all of these people that I showed you didn't come back alive. Only my mother and I. So when in 1938 I was 3 years old, when the Munich Agreement was made in Munich between Hitler, Mussolini, Chamberlain and the French foreign minister, the Czech representative was not invited because Hitler didn't recognize the Republic of Czechoslovakia. So they weren't invited, but they decided about Czechoslovakia because they decided that, well, we will give Hitler the Sudetenland and we will have peace, or we will avoid war. That was the reason that Chamberlain was pushing for it. He had lived through the First World War, which was a horrible war. I don't know if it was more horrible than the Second World War. Hard to decide which was more horrible. But it was also a terrible war, and the millions of people died and suffered. He wanted to avoid it at all costs. But in order to avoid it, he had to close his eyes, close his ears, and forget using his brain. Because everybody by that time, in 1938, knew that the Third Reich was preparing for war.
Yeah.
Armament industry was working double time. And fact is, the first people who were suffering from this were actually the German people, because the Germans, anybody who was against the government, the socialists, communists, whatever they were immediately put into camps. I don't know if we can call them concentration camps. They were put into camps and were used as slave laborers in the industry to produce the panzers and the artillery and the rifles and everything else. So in 1938, when the Munich Agreement was signed, within hours, the German army was inside Sudetenland. And the Jews immediately became the, what we call the people who were ostracized, dehumanized, segregated in ways that I, as a three-year-old, of course, didn't know.
Yeah.
But it was quite obvious that, for example, my parents and grandparents couldn't buy Alt Eisen and couldn't sell because nobody would buy from them and nobody would sell from them. Even my mother, who survived the Holocaust, used to tell a funny story. She said, oh, we had such a wonderful apartment and I had a bell here and a bell here. And every time I pressed the button and you, my name was Peter, you cried, I would ring the bell and she would come and take you and then take you for a walk. Oh, I had a very good life. Of course, all that finished because the nanny that was taking care of me didn't come afterwards anymore, because not because she didn't want to so much, because she was afraid. Working for a Jew was a no-no. Oh, no. And I can only tell you that I, having been a small little boy, I remember at one point we were going at the middle of the night to the train station, and I was 3 years old. I had my birthday in March, and I had a little tricycle that had all red, tricycle with black handlebars, and of course I wanted to take it with me. And my parents said, nein, 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 du kannst es nicht nehmen. Wir haben nicht genug Platz. Schau, wie viele Koffer wir haben. Und also wir werden dir kaufen ein neues. Das hat nicht, das didn't happen. It didn't happen. And even my grandfather, and I can show you here a picture, another picture, I think I have. Oh, where is it? My other grandfather, somewhere, hold on, be patient. Ah, here. No, this is a different one. My other grandfather, was also with me, said, I will take it for him. I'm the nein nicht in German.
Kein Platz.
And so we got on a train and we 2 hours later we arrived in Prague, and we lived on, not far from Wenceslav Namesti, Václavské Namesti, which is the center of Prague. Have you ever been in Prague?
Yes, I've been there once for the Hockey World Championships.
oh, that was a good time. Very good. Anyway, it's a really a lovely city. And we lived on the third floor, and the same process that was took place only a couple of years earlier in Karlsbad took place in Prague. Same thing. Every day a new announcement. Jews have to be inside the house after 8 o'clock. Jews have to wear the Star of David. Here it is. This is actually an original, it's not a copy. It's an original that my mother actually wore on every time she went out. She wore it, if it was on her blouse or on her jacket or on a sweater, she always had to move it. She had a pin here, move it from one to the other. It couldn't go out.
Do you have to wear it as well, or was it not possible for kids?
Up to 10 years old, you didn't wear it. After 10 years old, you had to wear it. But every day a new announcement was made. Jews had to be home. Jews had to turn in typewriters and cameras and radios. Jews were not allowed to have radio. If somebody had a radio and would listen late at night, maybe the BBC news, because there was a connection. But it was at that time we didn't have computers and telephone handies like we have today. Somebody would hear it and would report it. The Gestapo would come and they would take not only the radio, they would take the entire family, and you would never see them again. So there was a tremendous lot of fear terror felt by all the people. Even I, as a little boy, I was now 4 years old, 5 years old. I remember my grandfather took me to a little park playground right near the house. We were living on a street called Itasca. Itasca means Italian street. It wasn't Italian, it was just the name. And I remember there was a swing there and slide there, and there was one swing that was in the shape of a little boat, you know? And I would run to it and climb in at 4 or 5 years old, and my grandpa would push me, and I was so happy. is that, and he said one day, no, Peter, nein, du kannst nicht da gehen. Komm zurück. And I was angry at him. And why can't I go? What's wrong? What did I do? And he took me by in his arms and he pushed me out of there and said, you see here, du siehst du, da seht, da ist geschrieben, Juden verboten. And I didn't understand it. Why? What did I do? What was wrong? I mean, I knew I was Jewish, but was I not a good boy? Did I do something bad? And try to explain to me, and of course I didn't understand. So this was the type of thing that was happening to me personally, but to all the Jewish people, to all the Jews, no matter what they did, where they were. We were, you know, there was a period a little while ago when the corona was very spread all over the world. And especially in America, they said, oh, we don't want to wear a star. We don't want to go with a mask. It's like the Jews had to wear the star. And I went on TikTok and I said, this is ridiculous. You are crazy. The star was being worn by people so they can be segregated, humiliated, ostracized, subjugated to all kinds of laws, not for their protection, but for their separation. And you are wearing a mask to protect yourself, to stay alive, to protect other people from getting ill, from dying. It really upset me terribly. So that's one of the reasons we also got onto TikTok. And then the war started. In 1941, first of all, you remember that 1938, a few months after he got the Sudetenland, Hitler marched into Prague. The road was opened. The Czech army had been demobilized. The rifles and trucks and guns and cannons were all put back into the storerooms. And he declared from the castle, Hradčany, which was the government house, which still is there, by the way, today, there's no more Czechoslovakia. This is the Sudetim. This is the protectorate of Morava and no more Czechoslovakia. And then in 1941, they decided we're going to take all the Jews from all Czechoslovakia, from all over, and concentrate them in certain places. And Theresienstadt was one of those places. Theresienstadt had been, I don't know if you know from history, that Theresienstadt had been a sort of military outpost even before World War I. So there were kasernen in there, mm-hmm. Barracks, not wooden ones, big buildings, 6-7 of them. Hamburger Kaserne, Hanover Kaserne, all the various names, and they called it resettlement. They didn't call them concentration. They said, you know, settlement, we're taking the Jews from here, putting them there, and everything will be fine.
I know the word they use is Mustersiedlung, because the Nazis wanted people to go there to see, like, how good the people live there.
How wonderful it was.
Yes.
And they were, Nazis were very good at putting up a show. Of course, in the beginning, it was extremely difficult because, for example, my father and my grandfather were one of the first, you know, they were the second transport to Theresienstadt. And they promised the men, it was only men, two first to transport, one was in end of November and one was the beginning of December, 4th of December. And I have documents that I can show you that it says exactly the date, the place, etc., etc. I have it here, and if you wish, I will show it to you. And I remember my grandfather and my father coming to the hospital. I was in a hospital because I had my tonsils out, so I couldn't speak. Because it's when you take your tonsils out,
it's really painful.
Very painful. And I remember them coming and saying goodbye to me, and I couldn't say a word. I couldn't say. But they brought me one thing: ice cream. In Czech, ice cream, that's zmrzlina, terrible word. And I, of course, I ate it. I had it and I was happy, but I, of course, I was 5.5 years old. I didn't understand what was happening. And okay, and they went. And then 2 weeks later, on the 14th of December, we had to report to the same Bahnhof in Prague. And if you can imagine, mothers, and women with children, without children, one, two, three children, all being put on the floor of the Bahnhof. And said, food, you want food? Whatever food you brought with you, this is your food. If you didn't bring, you will be hungry. There was no place to go and buy and get food. This was what you had. You bought my sandwich, you bought an apple, this and that. And we slept on the floor for 2 days, crowded. You know, everybody was looking for a little space to put their bedroll in their suitcase. I remember only feeling so uncomfortable, so crowded, so miserable. And people were not always kind with each other. You know, this is my spot, this is my spot. No, I was here first. You know how people are when they're under terrible stress. And then after 2 days, we went on to this train, very crowded. And 2 hours later, we arrived in Bolshevice, not in Terezin, because the railway line finished in Bolshevice. And so we had to get out. It was very cold. December is cold in Czechoslovakia like it is cold in Germany.
Yeah.
It was very cold, and we had to walk. And I remember my mother walking in front of me with a suitcase and a knapsack, and I was also schlepping, holding on to a suitcase and also a knapsack. And I remember one thing, a man was walking next to me, and he saw I could hardly walk, and he helped me with the suitcase. And then we arrived in Theresienstadt, and then they put us in, my mother and I, children and women, little, small children and women, were put in a barracks called Dresden. Only women and children. And one of the women yelled out to the German soldiers, "No, when do we see our husbands? Where are our husbands, our fathers?" They called it out in German. They said, "Well, morgen früh, 6 Uhr, geht ihr zu dem Fenster und wird ihr sehen, the Männer gehen by, die gehen zur Arbeit." So that's exactly what happened. We all were put into a room with 10, 12 other people, children and mothers, in bunk beds, three high. And at 6 o'clock in the morning, the kids got up, of course, we all got up and ran to the windows. And true enough, we saw the men marching by downstairs on the street, five, in rows of five abreast, 50, 50, 50. But they were scared to look up. I called up to my father, Ernst, Arnold. And he didn't look. I think he was afraid because any man who looked up to see their son or daughter probably would get a hit with the butt of a rifle or kicked or something. So he went by, but he said, no, but I didn't see my grandfather. I didn't see my grandfather. I loved my grandfather. I can't see where my... I had a picture of him here. Somehow he disappeared on me. In any case, fact is, we never got to see my grandfather. He died in the concentration camp in Theresienstadt. And my father, I remember seeing him in 4 years twice. In the third year, he was sent to Auschwitz. And we found out now, not long ago, that he actually was part of Mengele's medical experiments, medication, and because they were experimenting on medication against typhus, and then he was put under transport to Buchenwald, and that's it. We have no more that. Either he died on the way to Buchenwald, or he died in Buchenwald.
What was his name?
His name was, here, this is my father, before he was sent to Theresienstadt. He is already a very bored man.
Yeah, really handsome with a answer.
Yeah, that's right. He was applying for exit visa, which he never got, I guess. That's what happened. Anyway, so this was the beginning of my stay in Theresienstadt. Now, if you want to ask more questions, please.
Yeah, how was it like to live there? You didn't get much food. How was it for the kids to live there?
Okay. Theresienstadt was somewhat of an unusual concentration camp. Fact is, the Germans never referred to it as a concentration. Ein Lager. It was a new settlement, and the Nazis wanted to turn it into a model resettlement. Now, because the majority, not all, but the majority of the prisoners there were from the Czechoslovak Republic, there was the intelligentsia, the Jewish intelligentsia was actually there. There were the lawyers and the doctors and the musicians and the artists and the dancers. At different points, different times, these people were allowed to be active in their specific categories. They had concerts there and music, and even they had not schools, they didn't allow for schools, but they had groups doing drawings with a huge amount of children's drawings that survived. Somebody hid it, and some 3,000 drawings of children were found. I'll show you later on. I just recently discovered that I had drawn, and they just in Israel there's a center called the Beit Terezin, Theresienstadt Memorial, where there are pictures and all kinds of things, and they discovered that I had actually drawn a little picture, and I'll show it to you, that of a football field player. In any case, so the people in Theresienstadt were not in a death camp. But in spite of that, it was so crowded at certain times that many people died, not only from overwork and hunger, but also because of the different sicknesses like typhus and diarrhea. It spread, so something like 35,000 people died in 4 years. Now, as far as the children is concerned, at one point or another, there were children who were living there, and children from the ages of 0 to about 17, 18, who stayed there for a while, and then their parents were, or their, especially their mothers, were sent away to Auschwitz. And out of 15,000 or something close to that, only about 100, some people say 92, some people say 102. Very difficult to keep complete track, and I don't think anybody really knows exactly, that survived. And I am one of those who survived.
You were now, really lucky then.
I was lucky, and partially it was, you know, circumstances. I can tell you only that we were hungry from morning to evening, from evening to morning. I was in Dresden, Kaserne for 4 years, and part of the time, or good part of the time, we were constantly looking for ways that we could find a little bit of food, another piece of bread, maybe a piece of carrot, because they also, they were outside of the walls of the concentration camp, there were gardens, they were growing vegetables for them. And we worked there, even as kids. I was 7, 6, 7, 8 years old, and I remember. And if you had a chat.
Oh, pardon.
Yeah, go.
Can you remember the SS guards? How are they treating the people there?
Now, this is very important to know. The SS were not the guards there.
Really?
Yes, it was the Czech army or Czech gendarmerie, the police, who were doing that. The SS were in charge.
Yeah.
And you have to also remember, next to the main ghetto was the Kleine Festung, which was a horrible, even worse place than Terezin. So the Terezin, they didn't gas people and they didn't shoot people. If they were sent, if they did something that was some kind of a unallowed project or something, and they were caught, they were sent to the Kleine Festung. And there, very few of the Jews that were sent there came back alive. But that was a separate part. And in the concentration camp itself, people sometimes, there were performances. Sometimes the performances were so good on such a high level that the commanders of the ghetto, the German commanders of the ghetto, went to see it. It was so good. The problem, the insidious problem of all of this was that the same people who played the violin or conducted an orchestra or played in a show, in a cabaret, the next day or the next week or the next month were sent to Treblinka or to Auschwitz or other places.
Who decided the names which people had to go to Auschwitz or to Treblinka?
Okay, so this is a very good question. Who decided on these specific people who were actually the Jewish representatives who were more or less running the ghetto? But who gave the command to them, we want today 200 or 500 or 2,000 people or tomorrow to replace? Who you send, up to you. So it was a terrible responsibility to choose.
That's the worst part. So you have to you do that to your own people. You have to send them away and you know what's happening.
Exactly. Now, the important thing to remember is, sorry.
Bless you.
The people in Theresienstadt did not know that the places like Treblinka and Auschwitz and Dachau and Mauthausen and Majdanek were death camps.
Oh, okay. I thought they...
We did not know.
Yeah.
We did not know. We knew it was bad, worse than what we were going through, but we didn't know that there were such things as gas chambers.
You cannot imagine this. It's beyond imagination.
I can just show, tell you this. Remember, I showed you this picture. Oh, here's the picture. Oh, here's the picture. Now I found this is what this is my father's. This is my father's family. My grandfather is holding me, my father, and my grandmother. Here I'm 3 years old. This is a few weeks before we were sent to Theresienstadt.
A really loving family.
I did, as far as I can remember.
Yeah.
The thing here is that the fact that people were coming to Theresienstadt and then they were sent further to death camps, we knew it was bad. Nobody wanted to be sent. But we didn't know it was death. And I give you, I showed you at the beginning the picture of my great-grandmother, my grandfather's mother. She was here 83 years old. She arrived in Theresienstadt in 1943. And few months after she arrived, she was sent to Treblinka. Now, I remember going with my mother to the train station in Theresienstadt. It actually wasn't a station. It was just the end of the railway line. And she was standing sort of on the side. And my mother and I were coming to her, and she was dressed just like you see here, in a long, nice, fine dress. And she saw that my mother was very worried. And she says, "Was wohl, hab keine Angst. Was wohl, hab, mach nichts aus. Ich bin doch eine alte Weib. Was können die machen zu mir? Ich kann nicht mal, sogar nicht arbeiten." She said it in German, just as I said it. And of course, that was the death sentence, because the people who could work in places like Auschwitz and Dachau and Buchenwald, maybe they had a little chance of surviving. But people like her, just imagine, 83 years old, being put on a train, maybe spending day, 2 days on the street, crowded, with no place to poop, as they say in America, or pee except in the pail. Then arriving in Treblinka, being told to disrobe, being shaven, and then told, "Now you're going to take a shower." And imagine these people thinking, I imagine my grandmother thinking, "Oh, ich werde ein Dusch machen. Oh, wir werden sauber sein."
Yeah.
But ein Dusch was a gas.
It's unbelievable. And I was standing in Dachau, because it's close to Munich, and I was visiting with my class to the concentration camp, and we were standing in the gas chambers, and it's just unbelievable.
How can people be so cruel, so inhuman one to another, just because they're not German, or because they're Slavic, or because they're Jews, or because they are gay people or homosexuals? I'm sorry, I find it totally unacceptable. I was also now in Dachau, not long ago. I have actually a friend who lives outside of Dachau, who also, one of the two he and I are two out of the 100 or 90 some children who survived.
Is his name and Ernst Gruber?
Nein. Michael, Julie, what is his name? Michael Grunberg. Michael. He's my age. He's about half a year younger than I am.
I was talking to another lady who survived Theresienstadt, but she was deported to Auschwitz. Her name is Dita Graus. I'm not sure if you know her.
No, I don't know her.
Because many people were transported, and she was living in Auschwitz in the family camp.
In the family camp, yeah. There are very many different categories of people. I always tell people, even if two men were in the same concentration camp, their stories are definitely different one from the other.
Yeah.
Why? Because we are different people, because the circumstances are different, because the times are different, because the things change and develop, and each one of us has a totally different. I'm from Theresienstadt. All I can tell you is it was a horrific place. I had a couple of friends that I don't even remember their name, but I tell you one story that you will be able to remember, because we were living in a room with another 10 or 12 other people, and for some reason, I cannot tell you why, for a short period, my mother and I and another young woman and her 7-year-old pretty, pretty girl were living in one little sort of like a closet, but it was just almost privacy for us. And both her mother and my mother were working in a factory splitting glimmer. Glimmer, that was a stone that was mined by the men, and it was being split into thin layers so that the Germans could use it for the war industry as insulation material. And as long as they, I guess, worked hard and made enough that the Germans were satisfied, the women stayed, so the children stayed. And from time to time, the German overseers, they did Stichprobe. You know, all of a sudden, weighing how much each went. And my mother stayed. And the women went to work at 6 in the morning, came back at 6 in the evening. So I spent a lot of time with this little girl. Her name was Jenny. And I loved this little girl. You know, love, you know, has many phases to it, but just imagine a 7 or 8 year old just being very much together. And I remember that. And she was acrobat. She loved to stand on her hands and do somersaults and all kinds of things. I mean, I really loved it. And then one day, her mother received the notification that she has to report to the Bahnhof. And that was the end. And for days I cried, and I was so sad. And my mother was a little bit harsh, and she didn't say, "Why are you crying? Oh, they went away." So, and she was not helping me cope with the situation.
You never saw her again?
Never saw her.
Did you see your father before he had to go into Auschwitz? Could you say goodbye?
Yes, he didn't say goodbye. I can only tell you that my mother actually went down to the train to see him off. And, you know, you were not allowed, but the long train, that she saw him through a a little window in because this was not anymore a train for people. It was a cattle train with little windows and things. And he took an envelope, something like this, an envelope. And in the envelope, there was this picture of my mother. Show you. He had been carrying with him all these years, every time he went out to work or wherever. And in it, there was also a little emblem of Terezin that he had somehow made or found or given some bread to somebody to get it. And he threw that to my mother. I'm sorry, I don't have the emblem here because I gave it to my oldest daughter to hold. And so it's right now in America. But, and she ran and picked it up and took this. So I didn't see my dad. I remember seeing my dad twice. Once he actually came to the caserne, to rest in caserne, and spent half an hour with my mother. And one time I saw him outside. I can't remember seeing him more. But the general atmosphere, even on the day that the Red Cross came to Terezin, so the Red Cross were about 100 meters, maybe 200 meters, with cameras, and the Germans had set up a playground and taken, I remember them being taken by a truck to the playground and said, Spiel, play, here's for you. And the Red Cross through the cameras and films filming us. And they set up a whole street. They had painted stores and people went in to buy things. They buy clothing that they had taken away from the Jews. And they printed money like Monopoly money. It was such a terrible bullshit, such terrible lies, so insidious. And they had a concert, and they had people sitting watching, Jews sitting watching the concert. If you look carefully at the people, they don't seem too happy. They seem a little bit worried. And they should have been, because all of them afterwards ended up on a transport to Auschwitz.
And they showed the video to the German people to show them how happy.
I don't know if they ever managed to do that. And there's a question about whether they actually made the movie theaters. But they wanted to. They wanted to do it.
Do you experience a personal miracle during all those times in Theresienstadt? You say that's a miracle I survived, or a miracle I made it through?
I think yes. I always tell people, first of all, I want to make sure that you understand, for 25 years at least, I didn't speak about my experience. I was concentrating on now and tomorrow. I came to Israel in 1959. I had first gone to America and Canada because I had a great aunt, the sister of this woman, sister of my grandmother. This is my great grandmother Rosa, and she had seven or eight sisters. One of them settled in Brooklyn, New York, and she found us after the war and guaranteed us, because the Americans didn't allow all Jews to, you are a survivor, come to America. No, you had to have somebody who sponsored you.
Okay, I did not know that. I thought you can just go there and they help you.
Oh, no.
Okay.
There was a certain number and you received the number. Once you found us, we were on a waiting list, and we waited from 1946 to 1948 to be told, yes, you can come to America. I, in the meantime, wanted to come to Israel. There was no Israel yet, it was Palestine, but My mother said, "Begin nach Amerika." Tante Flora hat uns geschrieben, wir können sein mit ihr. So we went to Brooklyn, New York, and after a year, we went to Toronto, Canada, and then I joined the youth group having to do with Israel, and became a Zionist, a good Zionist, wanting to build a land. I really felt that, you know, why shouldn't the Jewish people have a land of their own? We have roots in this part of the country, in this part of the world. So I joined, and 10 years later, 1959, I came to Israel. And then I got married, had 2 children, got divorced, got remarried, had another 4 children. And now I have 6 children, 15 grandchildren, and 2 beautiful, beautiful great grandchildren. Daughters.
How old are them?
What?
How old are the little ones, the grandchildren?
Yes.
How old are they?
Ah, how old? The grandchildren, well, the grandchildren, the oldest one is 30, and the youngest one is, the youngest one is 2 years old.
Okay. Oh, it's a little one.
And he's the son of my youngest children, and they live not in Israel, they live right now in Brussels, and he's a dancer.
Ah, okay. Oh, cool.
The grandson. The little one maybe will be also. Who knows?
So what about your personal miracle? You say it's that you survived this so you can...
I think, you know, I survived a lot of other things. First of all, I also survived 2 bouts of cancer. I had cancer of the what is it called? The big, forgot the name. I had 2 times cancer. The second time of the Shalpuchit Hashet, and I can say it in Hebrew. Bladder cancer.
Oh, okay. Blase.
I have no bladder.
Mm-hmm.
But I still go to the toilet.
So it seems like you're a cat with 9 lives.
It's sometimes, I always tell people, I don't know if there is a God. I really don't. I know, I can tell you that after we came back to Prague, after being released from Theresienstadt, I prayed every day. For months, I said, "Lieber Gott, bitte, bring my father. Bitte." He didn't bring, so I don't know if there is a God. But I say, there's someplace a star up there that's watching over me. Maybe.
Can you remember the day you got liberated from the Russians?
Oh, yes, I know the date exactly. It was the 5th of May. The Russian army was on the way to Prague, and the highway was passing by Prague, and as we heard the noise and we saw the Germans, the last German guards getting away with their families, getting on trucks and leaving, so we knew something was going, and all of a sudden we heard the yelling from other concentration camp people that the Russians, no, the American coming. American, the Britain, the Russian. Was the Russian army going to Prague because there was an uprising in Prague in May 1945, and the Russian army was going there to help them out. And all this, by the way, I wanted to say, but I didn't show you, but my partner, Julie, my wife died 10 years ago. I was married to her for 40 years. So, after that, I started sitting down and writing and recollecting. Then I needed an editor, somebody who makes out of all these words a book. And I found, by sheer luck, another lucky thing, my partner, Julie, and she's an editor. And we became much more than editor and writer, we became like married couple, maybe more so even. And we wrote this book together. I can show you.
I saw this. Yeah, I googled it and I found it on Amazon and
yes,
all the platforms. No, I just found it today, so I have to.
Okay, goodbye. We want to get it translated into German.
Oh, that would be great. But I can read English as well, so.
Oh, great. No, for you, yeah. For women. But I think it's important.
Yes.
I think it's a good book because it is. It doesn't deal only with the Holocaust. It deals with life.
Yeah.
It deals with hope. And you will see.
I just wanted to ask you how you got into TikTok.
Well, you tell.
We heard that it was a great way to draw more attention to our book. And so we went on TikTok and it turned out it was a great way to draw attention to anti-Semitism. So
yeah.
That's on it just to promote the book, and we're staying on it because of the Holocaust education that is needed.
Yeah, it's good to reach out to young people who use this platform. So
yeah.
I guess like many people don't know exactly what happened, and it's good that you just keep going and keep telling the story. So it's not.
We're trying.
So you won't forget it.
We discovered that there's so much ignorance.
Yeah.
So much hate. So much anti-Semitism. And sometimes just plain hate against anybody and everybody. Whether it be LGBT people, whether it be Muslims or even Jews, whatever.
Yeah.
And I have this little space that I can express myself today, and I'm ready to, and I hope it will have a little impact.
Yeah, I think it does.
Especially on young people.
Yeah. How do you deal when someone writes you insulting comments or insulting messages?
Well, we deal with it in two ways. One is the worst. The really terrible things, Julie doesn't let me see.
Yeah.
She mixes it. But in most cases, we answer. Look, for example, I give you an example. Somebody called me, "You are a liar. You're making this all up. This has never happened." And I said to him, "You know what? I truly wish it was a lie, because had it been a lie, I would have had aunts and uncles and a father and grandfather and grandmothers and cousins and a childhood. I don't have them, and I never did."
Yeah.
So there are many ways. Sometimes people warned us, don't engage them, because they use it for their own ends, to make themselves more popular. So sometimes not reacting is the best way, and sometimes I can't help myself but to react.
Yeah. In your profile it says, maybe I say it in German, it says Shoah-Überlebender, Schelm und Optimist. How did you get your optimism from? Where does it come from?
From inside my soul. From inside my soul. It's too easy to give up and to give in. Hope is sometimes tricky, even dangerous, but it's the future. That's why I speak, TikTok is why I speak to groups, is why I speak to you, because you are the future. If you won't make this world more better, who will? Who will? We won't be here. In another few years, there won't be any survivors. I'm 87 years old. I can do only so much in the few years that I have left. But it's you, the young people. No, I was now in Tel Aviv and I saw some groups there of young people, Czech people. And you know, the tour guide or whatever the guide was explaining, and I went over. I said, "Sorry, I'm interrupting you, but I am We don't live, and I spent 4 years here. Can I tell you a couple of things? He said, yes, yes, yes. And they pointed to one boy and said, he knows English well. Tell us in English and he will translate. And afterwards, they said, thank you. And just as we were leaving, three girls ran over and said, could we please take a picture with you? I said, of course you can. I'm happy to take a picture with three beautiful young ladies. Wow.
It's so important, your work, what are you doing, that you reach out to young people over a new platform, and so you can reach so many with one video or one thing you say.
Yes, exactly.
That's really great. Have you ever walked Theresienstadt ever again after after the war? Have you been there?
No, I've been there only 5 times.
Okay. How are your feelings when you go there?
You know, every time it's been a different thing. The first time I was there was in 1989 when the communist regime was falling apart. And it was very strange. And I was there with four of my six children. And I wasn't yet connected too much. But every time I went there back again, and especially this time, it was very, very meaningful and very, very intense. And we are doing a documentary film about my life, not just Theresien, not just the Holocaust, all together.
Yeah.
And it was not easy, not easy.
What advice would you give to the young generation or to young people, what to do with their life, how to be an optimist?
Well, I can't tell them be an optimist. I can only tell you, be connected, be aware, be on guard, react. Don't let things just happen as if they don't touch you, because one way or another, things happen and they will touch you, and they will affect you and your life and your family and your kids. So be connected, be aware, question, don't take things for granted.
Especially freedom and democracy,
democracy, yes. And don't expect 100%.
Yeah.
There is 100%. But if it gets to 85%, that's pretty good already. That's pretty good.
That's true. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
I'm very happy to talk to you. Very.
History, Wissen. Das Ghetto Theresienstadt. Das sogenannte Ghetto Theresienstadt wurde während des Zweiten Weltkriegs im besetzten Teil der Tschechoslowakei eingerichtet. Die Bezeichnung Ghetto oder jüdischer Wohnbezirk verschleierte den eigentlichen Zweck des Lagers, weil es den Häftlingen einen längeren Aufenthalt suggerieren sollte. Jedoch diente Theresienstadt nur als Sammel- und Durchgangslager. Zunächst sollte es der Aufnahme von Gefangenen aus der Tschechoslowakei dienen. Bald wurden jedoch Menschen aus fast ganz Europa dorthin deportiert. Theresienstadt wurde zu einem Lager unter jüdischer Selbstverwaltung erklärt, was praktisch bedeutete, dass die Gefangenen selbst für Unterbringung, Nahrung, medizinische Versorgung oder die Betreuung und Verpflegung der Kinder sorgen mussten. Nur dem Namen nach wurde das Ghetto durch einen Ältestenrat verwaltet, der durch den Judenältesten geleitet wurde. Doch in Wahrheit unterlagen alle Entscheidungen dem SS-Lagerkommandanten. Die SS präsentierte Theresienstadt als Musterlager und gaukelte der Weltöffentlichkeit ein heiles Leben vor. Es war jedoch ein Ort des Grauens und ein Zwischenstopp in die Gaskammern. Trotzdem gab es ein geistig-kulturelles Leben. Jüdische Musiker, Maler und Wissenschaftler entfalteten eine enorme Produktivität. Lehrkräfte unterrichteten Kinder in Kellern oder auf Dachböden. Es gab Theater- und Kabarettvorstellungen. So gelang es den Menschen, zumindest zeitweise, die Todesangst zu verdrängen und von Normalität wenigstens zu träumen. Die NS-Propagandamaschinerie bediente sich der Kinder und der Künstler und vermarktete Theresienstadt als Muster-KZ. Tatsächlich gelang es Repräsentanten des Internationalen Komitees des Roten Kreuzes, die sich ein Bild von den Lebensumständen verschaffen wollten, zu täuschen. Auch einen zynisch perfiden Film über die heile Welt in Theresienstadt ließ die SS drehen. Regie führte Kurt Gerand, ein deutsch-jüdischer Schauspieler, der nach Ende der Dreharbeiten 1944 in Auschwitz ermordet wurde. Unter den Häftlingen in Theresienstadt befanden sich etwa 9000 Kinder, von denen etwa nur 2000 überlebten. Gidon Lew war eines von diesen Kindern aus Theresienstadt. Bei unserem Gespräch ist mir vor allem Gidons positive Art aufgefallen. Sein Optimismus ist sehr ansteckend und er sorgt sofort für gute Laune, wenn man ihm begegnet. Von seiner Vergangenheit sind ihm jetzt nur noch die Bilder seiner Eltern, Großeltern und Urgroßeltern geblieben. Ich fand es beeindruckend zu hören, dass er und seine Mutter sich nach dem Krieg aktiv für das Leben entschieden haben und einen Neustart in Amerika gewagt haben. Vor 10 Jahren starb Gidons zweite Frau an Lungenkrebs. Auch er selbst hat den Krebs zweimal bekämpft und ihn auch zweimal besiegt. Freunde von ihm rieten ihm damals, sein bewegtes Leben aufzuschreiben. Auf der Suche nach einer geeigneten Autorin lernte er vor wenigen Jahren die US-Amerikanerin Judy Gray kennen. Diese schrieb mit ihm das Buch »The True Adventures of Gidon Lew – Rascal, Holocaust Survivor, Optimist«. Gerne könnt ihr auch auf seinem TikTok- oder Instagram-Kanal weiter stöbern oder auch sein Buch lesen, wenn ihr noch mehr über ihn erfahren möchtet. Gidons Geschichte zeigt vor allem, dass man nicht aufhören sollte, an das Positive im Leben zu glauben und sich auch trauen, weiterhin optimistisch zu sein. Ich bin sehr dankbar, dass sich Gidon die Zeit für meinen Podcast genommen hat. Wenn auch du dir seine Geschichte angehört hast, bist auch du einer dieser Zeitzeugen, die dazu beitragen, dass seine Geschichte nicht in Vergessenheit gerät. Ich würde mich sehr freuen, wenn du mir eine positive Bewertung hinterlassen könntest und den Podcast deinen Freunden und Bekannten weiterempfiehlst. Ich wünsche dir ein glückliches, erfolgreiches und vor allem gesundes neues Jahr und hoffe, dass du das nächste Mal auch wieder mit dabei bist, wenn es heißt Wunder, Wissen, Weltkrieg.